I had the privilege tonight of meeting Damone Cook. Now, I don't know if you realize that he was with us as one of our audience members a few weeks back when Larry came to share with us. And I was like, man, that guy looks familiar. Where did I see him at before? But right here in our own Valley Group meeting, in his childhood, he was raised in Louisville, Kentucky, but now he lives in Santa Clarita. I'm from California. I should know how to say that. And he's got a home group, and it's called Certain Steps, which meets on Mondays and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Damone is a sponsor, and he even works in the field of recovery. And I hope we get to hear some of that story tonight. So if we could give a big Warm Valley Group welcome to Damone C, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks, Uncle Jim. Appreciate it. And thank you all at the Valley Group for having me come out and share my experience with the Hope of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Damone, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 18, 1997, and today I'd like to make the same deep personal commitment not to take a drink or drug just for today. My sponsor's name is Larry G, and my home group is Certain Steps. Meets on Mondays and Wednesdays, 5 p.m. Pacific time. It's a step meeting, a big book study. And also the men's happy hour that meets every morning on Zoom platform. It was started in Louisville, and I've been attending that as well every day. And a lot of the members from around the country that have joined us, they in here today, and some of the home group members out here. And I want to thank all of these people that I've met, you know, and even in Santa Clarita, Deborah, and also Ruben. And I'm happy to get support from Peggy and a lot of the other home group members, and Clee and everybody that's here. Thanks, Chris. And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to stop talking. 7:55, and I see the clock on my cell phone. The big book tells me to tell in a general way what I used to be like and what happened. What I used to be like before the program, what happened in the program, and what it's like now with the program. And that's how it was given to me. And I'll try to do that to the best of my ability. And I'm just real grateful to be here. And the words can't express the honor and the privilege to be able to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I'm going to get into. And my granddaddy was an alcoholic. He had 31 kids. All that means is I got a lot of butt whoopings. They passed me around the house like a joint. Even the dog that had alcoholism, I believe. We had a dog named Face. He was a beagle hound. I know Face had to be an alcoholic because he would leave. He'd do things like leave for 3 days and wouldn't nobody know where he was at. He'd get kicked in the head by horses. He'd get locked up in the dog pound. He'd get maced, jumped by a pack of dogs. So if he's in Dogs Anonymous or something like that, he got a story to tell. So he drank that brown whiskey. I had a lot of resentment, fear, guilt, and remorse. Before I even took a first drink, I used to get bullied a lot. And I remember I was going trick-or-treating. I lived in all the projects up in Louisville, Kentucky. That got jumped one time when I was 5 years old by some older kids while I was trick-or-treating by myself around this time of year. They pulled some rough projects called Southwick and Potter Homes in Peyton Place area in Louisville, Kentucky. And they pulled my shirt up over my head, and they beat me with some cable wires on my back, and then they stomped me and took all my trick-or-treat candy that I had in a little pillowcase. And I remember crying and being real furious, even from way back, you know. So living in the projects, I had a lot of fights, and I became very violent, and I became a bully myself, because I felt like in order for people to leave me alone, I have to be violent. And I used to see violence in the house. My stepdaddy used to beat on my mother. I used to hide up under the bed with my brothers and sisters when he get drunk. And I can remember having to resent me, you know. And one time I tried to help my mother, he turned around and broke my nose. And I remember crying in my pillow with resentment. My stepdaddy was on my inventory. And also my granddaddy was very abusive to everybody in the family. And he died of alcoholism. And my daddy, he used to drink, and somebody slipped him a Mickey in a club, and he lost his mind. He blew his brains out in my grandmother's basement. And I could remember just seeing a big puddle of blood. So by the time I took a drink, and when my little sister died and stuff, and I remember I took a drink. That first drunk was a 40-ounce of St. Ives malt liquor. And that's when the Dr. Dre video came out. And when Dr. Dre showed that video on Yo MTV Raps, it used to come on. When he opened up, you know, most people had relish and ketchup, mustard, and food in the refrigerator. They just had nothing but beer. And I said, yeah, that's what I'm talking. I had a St. Ives malt liquor. And when I had all this resentment on the inside of me, and when I turned that 40 ounce up, all that emotional barometer that I had, all that anger and all that stuff went away. And I found the answer. And I felt like God made anything better than this. He kept it for himself. And I used to hide beer behind the neighborhood store when school was starting in Kentucky. That's where I was born and raised. And I used to hide it behind the store so it could get a good frost on it. My mother thought I was a good student because I would leave early in the morning. Now, she thought I was being a good student so I could be at school early. But really, I was just obsessing over that 40 ounce all night. So I would leave early and go behind that store and get that 40 ounce. And I'd drink a 40 ounce of St. Ives before the school bus came. And I didn't know nothing about no phenomenon of craving. I just knew by the time I ate breakfast and played a little basketball, I needed to go get me another one. And I would go hang out with my buddy named Alvin. He'd be sitting on the corner on a grocery basket from the Winn-Dixie grocery store, slinging drugs. And he'd have a pint of whiskey and some weed with him. And I'd drink some more, and I'd pass out. And about 3-4 in the afternoon, and I was wondering how people stayed up all night, and I did some other stuff, like cocaine, to help me drink more, because I love to drink. That made me drink even more without passing out, and I could be in a live blackout until I get knocked out, or pass out, you know, something like that, or go to jail or something. But it interfered with my school. I became ineligible to play basketball. My disease was progressing to at the point I was missing school. And the game, I ran in gangs. My families had gangs in them, and I ran in gangs, and I did things the gangs do. And I got consequences behind that, and I seen a lot of people die as a result. And I ended up getting shot, lost my kidney, spleen, 2/3 of my pancreas. I had 2 heart attacks, collapsed lung. I died twice, and that just made me more of an alcoholic. I drank more. I called a case. I was looking at 20 years in penitentiary. My probation officer told me, look, you need to go to this place called the Healing Place, and I was 19 years old by this time, looking at 20 years in the penitentiary. And I had full-blown alcoholism. I had yellow jaundice eyes. I used to rub cocaine in my gunshot wound, and I would drink Everclear. And I was in full flight from reality. That was my prescription for pain. And he sent me to this place called the Healing Place in Louisville, Kentucky. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And I had a knife on me when I went in this detox. And this old black man named Mr. James, he was an old gangster. And he ran up on me, and I had this knife. And I was talking crazy to everybody. And he said, young man, I used to carry a knife until I found out I can kill a mother effer with my bare hands. And he took my knife from me and told me, set my behind down. I'm not the only crazy mother effer around here. And so I did, and I sat down, and I started, they told me go to these meetings, and they had AA meetings on the property, and I would go to these meetings every day. And they would have these groups called, and they would have classes, Recovery Dynamics, and they would explain the big book to me. And, but I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And I had, and I was already relapsing in my mind. I was, they let you leave on Saturday at 6 a.m., just got to be back at 4 p.m. And Jim's story said, you know what? I could mix whiskey with milk if only I drank it on a full stomach. That was Jim's theory. My theory was, you know, take a mountain bike, ride it to the hood, and take a drink. And by the time you ride it back to the healing place, you know, you've been sweating that alcohol out your body. And you could just eat something, take a shower, and nobody ever knows you took a drink. In Jim's story, he said the experiment worked so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into the milk. But my experiment worked so well that I tried it again. Every weekend, I'd just be drinking between meetings, and they had these on-property meetings. They would pass out chips like they did tonight, and I would go up, and I would get those 10-month chips, and I ain't even have a week, and everybody be clapping. And I said, see, I ain't no alcoholic. I'm just here because they snitched on me, and the police is here, and these people here in AA, and at this place they got me, and they just all snitches and federal informants, and they just trying to watch me. And I didn't, you know, and I was just drinking between meetings. And I would tell them what they wanted to hear. And then they would move me on in the program. But then I got to a point to where they boosted up my curfew from 4 p.m. and I eventually got it up to 11 p.m. and I went to my home group at the time, was the 36th Street group. It's on Friday at 8 o'clock in Louisville. I went up there, got me a 10-month chip, didn't have a week, everybody was clapping, and I drunk a fifth of Hennessy. By the meeting was over at 9 p.m. I had drunk a fifth of Hennessy by 9:45 p.m. And I was passing out on my mother's floor. And she said it when she woke up the next day, when she went in that room that I was sleeping in, she said it smelled like a liquor distillery. When alcoholics sleep, the alcohol come out their pores. And she was slapping me. She said, go back. Get up. Don't you got to go back to that place? And I went back to the place, and the lady named Miss Vanita was speaking, and she said, I said, yeah. I went back to this meeting called the Eye Opener, and the lady, a man was saying that he had relapsed, and I told him, keep coming back, it'll get better. He didn't know that I'm probably reeking of whiskey, but this lady named Miss Vanita was speaking. She said, you need to get honest, real loud, when she was speaking on honesty, and I just happened to be on the front row. She was looking at me. I was like, hey, and it cut through me like knives, because I knew I was Sharon King living dirty. I had a fake sobriety game that I needed to get honest about. I had a head full of AA and a belly full of beers. And then I called somebody and I told them that I relapsed. But I didn't know that it wasn't a relapse because I never did stop drinking. You know what I'm saying? I've just been drinking the whole time. So I went on a well-known spree. And this time it got to the point to where, see, I'd rather be shot again, locked up again, stabbed again, or whatever, jumped again, but I don't want to be in that soul sickness again, that dark, dark spot that God had me in, to where I was going to blow my brains out, but then the agony got, because the alcohol and drug, that stopped working. So I called my first sponsor. I was in pain. I was beat down. I didn't have no more fight left. I didn't have no more self-will ideas that I've been pulling. I ain't slick. I'm sick. I need help. And I remember calling my sponsor. I didn't have no bass in my voice. I had that whoop sounding voice, like I had my tail whoop. And I said, Kenny, I need help. And he came out, and my first sponsor was a guy named Kenneth Hinfield. He came out and he picked me up, took me to detox. And this time I was ready to actually work some steps. I was willing to do anything they asked me to do. Even if I had to clean up people and things like that. James, a guy on here now named Fred Stoner, he's at the meeting. He checked me in that day at detox. But I'll tell you, I'd do anything, you know. And so anything they told me to do, I was willing. And my sponsor got me in the inventory. And first of all, they told me, they said, Damone, you know what your problem is? I said, what? You don't know what your problem is. That's what your problem is. I'm going to tell you, that's what I used to be like, y'all. Okay? And I'm going to tell y'all what happened. This is what happened. I said, Damone, you know what your problem is? I said, what? He said, you don't know what your problem is. That's what your problem is. And they explained to me the doctor's opinion. And it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. That's on page XXVIII, Roman number 28 in the big book. To them, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontent, lest they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks that which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. And they said, Damone, how you feel when you take a drink? I said, I feel good. They said, they just let us know you must feel like crap when you're sober. And I did. I felt like crap sober. They said, we need to teach you how to feel good sober. And they told me the reason why I can't take a drink is because I got a physical allergy in the body. And they read this out the big book. And they said, Damone, the reason why you can't quit is because you got a mental obsession in the mind. You got a mind to tell you to start. I could see what alcohol could do for me, but I never could see what it's going to do to me. See, that's the difference between me and a normal person. See, a normal person, they can see what alcohol is going to do to them. They know it's going to, that's bad, that's poison. For me, it's feel good, it's a warmth all over my body. Where have you been all my life? The honeymoon period, it is on. The normal person take a drink, they'll stop, slow down, moderate, and say things like, hey, I'm going to the work tomorrow. I gotta go to school. But me, when I take a drink, the party has just begun. I don't stop. I speed up. I want more and more, another and another and another. See, the difference between me and a normal, temperate, moderate drink, I get a phenomenon of craving. And that, the only way I could crave alcohol and get this abnormal reaction that Silkworth's talking about is if I take that first drink. That produces the craving for the second. I go on the well-known stages of spree. You see, being in this vicious cycle like this, it made my life to become unmanageable. And that's what Bill's story, because see, this Silkworth talks about our body and our mind. And then he gives along in Bill's story, he tells us the progression of how this condition of alcoholism, drug addiction, affects a person's life. So they had me read Bill's story. And I was reading Bill's story and I seen how Bill's life, his wife, his school was affecting. I said, dang, I might not be a stockbroker. Just like Bill was the inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had him in his grip, where the inviting maelstrom of Victory Park and Shag Bark and West End and the streets of Louisville had me in his grip. They were my heroes, the pimps, players, and hustlers, and hoes, and all them. My heroes. You understand? They had me in this grip. And see, I was out here, and it affected my school. I couldn't play basketball, and I had resentment and things. My life had become unmanageable. And I said, y'all convinced me I got this problem. That's what's wrong with me. But just because I knew of my problem, I was like, man, what is the answer? I was desperate because I knew if I didn't get an answer. See, and then they described the fellowship on page 17. It says, we like the liner of a grape. After the liner, like a grape after a shipwreck. A great liner after rescue from shipwreck. And camaraderie. If you got an upper class, a middle class, and a lower class, on page 17 in the big book, says we are average Americans, all sections of this country, and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship of friendliness and understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We're like the passengers of a great liner. The moment after rescue from shipwreck, for camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy, for faith, the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy and escape from the disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in common prayer and one is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. And they explained that to me, and my sponsor said, Damone, it's all these people that was on the Titanic that was in this icy cold water drowning. Their lives was at stake. If somebody came up on them in a lifeboat and reached their hand out to get you out that water, you wouldn't say, you're too white to help me. I need somebody black to save me. You're too black to help me. I need somebody white to save me. What school you go to before you get me out this water? What's your credit score? Only people with an 850 credit score can save me. What church you go to? Now, I used to be a lifeguard, and look, I ain't never seen one drowning person. Oh, what's your political view before you get me out this water? None of that will matter. See, if you're looking at all that, see, a drowning person, they will grab hold for dear life. And that's how I had to go about grabbing this solution. My sponsor has something, and the fellowship has something that I didn't know. But specifically, my sponsor knew a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening. I was attracted to the love, tolerance, patience, courage, wisdom, and humility that he had. And I seen it in the fellowship, speaking the language of the heart. You see, I grabbed hold. I didn't care how old he was, what color he was, how many degrees. Your degrees don't matter if you drown. You understand? So I got up out there, I grabbed hold like the drowning person. I grabbed hold of the program and fellowship like a drowning person. You know, grabs hold of a life preserver. Because my life was at stake. I'm willing and desperate as the dying can be. I'm just talking about me. I don't want no more of that pain. I'm tired. It hurt me. I was dying on the inside. I cried when I seen my mother's eyes, when I couldn't give her a hug behind those bars, you know, when she come to see me. It hurt me. And I knew she was hurt. And I wanted a way out. This is the goal. They said, Damone, you're in the problem. We in the solution. This is the dark. This is the light. This is the failure. This is the success. That was then. This is now. This is pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. This is a degree of stability, usefulness, happiness, inner peace, and integrity. The feeling that I'm on the road is really going somewhere. This is court dates, bench ones, blackouts, handcuffs, gunshot wounds, crawling on floors, peeking out windows, running from the police, sleeping in ditches and laundromats, and divorce court, and all that stuff. Anybody can increase the list. And so they put me in a box. They said, you're either going to unify with the fellowship or pass off the scene. We AAs hang together or die separate. See? They put me in the box where I had to make a decision because they made the facts clear that this is the problem. And this is the solution. What do you want to do? We don't have time to be playing with you. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, man. You understand? If you still want to go get drunk, we buy you a drink. You understand? The first one's on me. And if you want to get sober, we'll have to stay sober. But we're not going to play with you. And when I said I was wanted what they had and I was willing to go to any length to get it, they made me have a decision. And me and my sponsor said a third step prayer, and he told me that turning over these basic instincts of life was social security and sex, and my ambitions for social security and sex is something I'll be practicing one day at a time for the rest of my life, is turning over my will and life over the care of God. And that's why he said the main problem centers in my mind. He told me that I can defeat alcoholism whenever I see my mental states that precede a relapse into the drinking. And that's why he explained Bill's story to me. Because see, and there's a solution. They said, when they put me in this box, when they said the spiritual experience, they said, this is the goal of the program. And Carl Jung said that this is what produces the entire psychic change that Dr. Silkworth was talking about. Spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. He said, he wrote a letter to Bill Wilson when he said, Spiritus contra spiritum. It means it takes a greater spirit to overcome the spirits. I was spiritually sick, and I had something wrong with me that a Cadillac, a relationship, a job, good credit, and all that was not going to fix. I had something wrong with me that was deep soul sickness, and only an act of providence could relieve it of me. I was hurt. They said, this is the goal of it. And if you want to turn over your real life, because I still had problems even though I said the third step prayer. And they said, of course, because you only made a decision. Because I was like, how am I still having problems and I turned my will and life over to God? They said, because you didn't turn it over in step three. You just made a decision. A decision without action, the moment is meaningless. Until you go and face all the things that's blocking you off from God. See, these are things that block us from God. And they said, that's resentment, fear and guilt. Because resentment, fear and guilt causes your emotions to build up. And when your emotions build up, Damone, your mind remembers success. And when you're in a lot of pain, your mind say, you know what you need to fix the pain that you're in. You need a drink. But if I take a drink, now I'm off and running again. So you need to face yourself. And it's a poem called A Man in a Glass in AA. It says, when you get what you want and you struggle for self, and the world makes you king for a day, just go to a mirror and look at yourself and see what that man has to say. For it isn't your father or mother or wife whose judgment upon you must pass, for the fellow whose verdict counts most in your life is the one staring back from the glass. Some people may think you're a straight shooting chum and call you a wonderful guy, but the man in the glass says you're only a bum if you can't look him straight in the eye. He's the fellow to please, never mind all the rest, for he's with you clear to the end. You can pass your most dangerous, difficult test if the man in the glass is your friend. Or you may fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on the back as you pass. But your final reward will be heartaches and tears if you cheated the man in the glass. And they said, Damone, we're not talking about no physical mirror. We're talking about your inner mirror. See, I've been sweeping stuff under the rug. I've been hiding things in the dark corner of my mind, hoping that they never see the light of day. And it's like if you open up your refrigerator and you smell some bad meat, you get rid of it promptly and without regret. In a business which takes no regular inventory, usually goes broke. Said, Damone, you're the most successful and the most important business that there is, the business of living. And there's things in myself that I didn't want to face. See, it's my inventory, not yours. There's things in Damone that I didn't want nobody to know. And I was scared to do a fearless inventory. How you do a fearless inventory and I'm scared to death? And the guy named Darrell Wells told me, said one time, he said, man, it's like sending one of your kids into the woods by itself. They're not going to go. But if you're their father, they take their father with them, they'll go. And that's why step three is before step four, for you can take your heavenly father, which is God, with you into those dark woods and look at yourself. I had to go down deep and looking at all that stuff, my resentments, because that was blocking me off from God. And I had to list all my fears and sex conduct and harms done to others. And I found out he gave us an example when he said, Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, my employer, and my wife. And he told his wife of his mistress, he's trying to get his job. You understand? And then he said, look, and also he has attention to his wife. And she's trying to gossip. She's a nut. She snubbed me, trying to commit a friend. And the employer is trying to fire him for stealing. He's going to fire him. And he made a list. And my wife, she likes Brown, and she wants the house put in her name. You understand? And she nags. And then I found out, and I went through my own personal life. I had people that shot me, people that lied on me. I had to put my stepdaddy, people that jumped me. I went all the way back. And I found out it wasn't these people that I was angry at. It's what they did. And then when I got over in the third column, it says, most cases in the big book was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our pride had been affected. So I had to with my social instinct, my security instinct was affected, disturbed, and interfered with. So it's not these people, it's what they done. But then when I get over the third column, it ain't even what they done. It's that myself is threatened. And then on 67, it says, we turn back to the list. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking? And I found if I wasn't so selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, Mr. Brown wouldn't have nothing to tell about and wouldn't be getting my job and threatening my instinct. It looked like a 1-2-3-4 problem, but really it's a 4-1-2-3 problem. Because this is where it all started. This is the root. That's why step 5 said admit to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature. Exact nature means root of my wrongs. And I found out that over here, if I wasn't so selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, probably inconsiderate, so the people, when they did what they did, it wouldn't threaten my instinct. So I set the ball rolling. I had to do this with the same formula with my fears and my sex conduct, harm none of it. You see, I had a lot of prejudice before against these spiritual terms, and it's doing, who would want to do something like this? You know, I'm going to read it in the 12 and 12. Because Bill Wilson said on page 24 in the 12 and 12, I'm telling y'all what happened. He said, while this insistence that every AA must hit bottom first, the answer is that few people, would sincerely try to practice the AA program unless they have hit bottom. For practicing AA's remaining 11 steps means the adoption of attitudes and actions that almost no alcoholic who is still drinking can dream of taking. Who wishes to be rigorously honest and tolerant? Who wants to confess his faults to another and make restitution for harm done? Who cares anything about a higher power, let alone meditation and prayer? Who wants to sacrifice time? Nobody, and energy in trying to carry AA's message to the next sufferer. No, the average alcoholic, self-centered and extreme, doesn't care for this prospect unless he has to do these things in order to stay alive himself. So that's what it takes. And I had a lot of prejudiced names about this spiritual experience, and when I read We Agnostic, you know, it's something that jumped out on me in We Agnostic throughout that whole chapter. And it starts on page 46. It said, let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness, and I noticed I kept seeing this word on page 47. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself. On page 48, it says, sometimes this was a tedious process. See, Bill, we hope no one else will be prejudiced for as long as some of us were. He kept saying that. On page 49, he said, we who have traveled this dubious path beg you to lay aside prejudice, even against organized religion. He came back on page 51, he said, we asked ourselves this, are not some of us just as biased, just prejudiced, and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit? On page 55, he said, we can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly. So he kept mentioning that word prejudice over and over and over again, and I kept saying, wow. You see, I'm prejudiced against the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it's like, Damone, who are you to say that a spiritual experience, you can't get one and you can't stay sober permanently? Because see, in our big book on page, in the fourth to the second edition on page XVII, it said, it also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery, no relapse. They said, now, Damone, who are you to say you can't have permanent relapse? How you know? I mean, permanent recovery, no relapse. How do you know when you ain't never done it? See, that's prejudice, Damone. You're trying to knock the program and you ain't never really tried it. And that's why in the back of the book, when he said, talks about spiritual experience and spiritual awakening, he says, there's a principle which is a bar against all information. which is proof against all arguments and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. That's Herb Spencer. You're knocking a program and you ain't even trying. How you know? You trying to knock something you ain't never tried. You ain't never turned your will and life over by doing an inventory. Ain't never done a fifth step. And when I sat down with my sponsor, I just read it across left to right. Because I needed to hear myself admit these things. So I just read it from left to right to him. He listened. And if it's something I didn't see, he would help me and share it, look, spring. And then doing that over and over on each one of these items that I wrote down, I was getting free. And felt like I was walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. So he showed me these directions. See, the way my sponsor told me to do the fourth step was right out of the big book. That's why I'm writing it on this board. He said, when he showed it to me, though, he said, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcohols than anything else. And he said, when the spiritual matter is overcome, we straighten out mental and physical. And dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry. That's column one. He said, we asked ourselves why we were angry. That's column two. That's the cause. He says, in most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, pocketbooks, and ambitions, that's column three. And then he went over to 67. He said, where you get that fourth column from? He said, well, putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done, we resolutely for our own mistakes, where we've been selfish, dishonest, and despite. And then consider it was on page 69 when he mentioned column four again. He said, we reviewed our own conduct over the years past, where have we been selfish, dishonest, despite, and considerate. This is what I admitted to him, selfish, dishonest, selfish. When I had a written inventory, that's why it says on page 75, we had a written inventory. This is what I had. I went to my sponsor with a written inventory, not a thinking inventory, a written inventory, a big book inventory, and explained to him what I'm about to do. And he said, I'm on a life and death errand. And he was glad to help, and he listened. And when I did that fifth step, I knew I didn't have to drink no more. I was like, man, I'm free, because he gave me my sixth step, the seventh step, and my fifth step. Because when I admitted these defects, I became willing to have God take them away, all of them, root and branch. And then, as he listened to my fifth step, he told me my eighth and ninth step. He told me how to make amends if I owed him money or if I owed him a face-to-face amends. And there's all these in the big book. It wasn't a problem that I had that my sponsor couldn't show it to me in the big book. And so I was confident in my sponsor, because if I had relationship problems, I had to go to jail sober. I had relationship problems. If I had family problems, if I had if people that I couldn't make amends to, if they were dead problems, then guess what? The answer was in the big book. I was ready to face life. And I began to get the promises of the big book. And he showed me how to do a 10 step. And I had to do a 10 step every day. Because he said, Damone, there are no new steps after step 9. Step 10 is just step 4 through 9 every day. And I used to call him. He would say, what you do today? How was your day at the end of the day? He would say, no, you need to go back and make amends and stuff like that. Because the thing about it, I can continue to grow. Because, see, we all need room to grow. And we all need room to allow other people to mess up and make mistakes. Because our kids are little, and you teach them how to ride a bike, how to walk, you know they're going to fall. So I had allowed myself to fall, give myself room to mess up, and practice the program. And by doing this every day, I was rocking into a fourth dimension of existence. I entered the world of spirit. And the only thing that's a comfort, because just like when a person is on a diet, you have to watch what you eat. And when you watch what you eat, you know, you're like, nah, I can't eat that. That's not healthy for me. So everything, even in AA meetings that I heard, is not healthy for you. Everything that you hear in AA meetings is not spiritually nutritious. I have to watch what you eat. I listen to all of it. But everything is not spiritually nutritious. And that's the most greatest thing that ever happened to me in the program. So where I'm at today in this program works through all areas, fair weather and foul. Stuff that I normally used to drink, though, I had two kidney transplants, so it'll help through relationship problems. I had a divorce sober. My mother died in my arms. They work through all them problems, and I was able to get through it sober and become a stronger member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And also, it's helped me go back to school. I was able to get my GED, go to college. I was able to get my certification to be an alcohol and drug counselor and a clinical supervisor. Today, I own my own company. It's called Professional Advocacy. We got one of the number one online addiction education courses that there is right now. We use recovery dynamics. People can get sober with the touch of a button. And at home, because everybody can't make it to treatment our halfway house. You know, so, and we take advantage of technology, even with the big book, what Bill Wilson says, and even in the treatment field, you know, he's able to use recovery dynamics. It's given by Joe. And Joe has impacted my life a great deal. My sponsor, Larry, who's been my sponsor for the past 17 years, has impacted my life a great deal. And I take time out to thank those fellas. I don't put them up on a pedestal like that, because if God is everything, I can't be no thing. If God has all power, the demon don't have none. And see, when I'm at a peace with my higher power, I like to be where he wants me to be, doing what he wants me to do. And that's the ultimate sign of humility to me, where I don't have to worry about nobody else. So now it's like, that's where I'm at today. I'm grateful for Joe, because somebody said, man, y'all was talking about Joe. We don't want to hear about Joe. I said, well, you talk about Bill and Bob. You understand? And you definitely don't have no problem with people talking about you in the meeting. So I'm going to talk about them all. And I'm talking about Bill and Bob and Joe and what God has done in their life. You know, so I'm real grateful to be here. I'm glad that you all came to this meeting of Alcoholics. I spend most of my time helping others if they want it. Because that's another word you'll see all throughout chapter 7, working with others. If they want it and need it badly. I'm a happily married man with kids and family, and I love you all. Thank you all for having me at this group. You some beautiful people. Where you start and where you finish, you got to start somewhere. They say the mighty oak tree once was a little acorn that stood its ground. And know this, you don't have to drink even if your ass fall off. And I'm an alcoholic named Damone. Thank you.
Thank you, Damone.